Hello everyone. So I think the space is just filling up now. I can see our first speaker, Fazila, has joined us already. And so we'll be able to. So yeah, hello again everybody. I'm just letting people into the space now, so we're just going to let the room fill up for a couple of moments. I'm sending notifications to all of our speakers, inviting them to become a speaker, so you should receive that and you'll then be able to speak. So I'm just going to pop my mic off for a moment while I make sure everyone's into the room, and then we'll begin our event today. Thank you. Hello, everybody. So I'm just adding the speakers now. I've added Freedom for Ocalan, our co-host for the day. And I'm just trying to get all of our speakers into the room now so that we can begin the event. I'm seeing a couple of people saying that they can't hear me. I'm speaking now, so I hope you can all hear me. If I can't, please let me know. Hello, everybody. Okay, so I'm speaking now. I'm just checking if I can be heard because a couple of people have said that they can't hear me speaking. If this isn't working, perhaps I'll have to try from another device.
I can hear you.
Okay,
This
you can
is
hear me. That's
Fazila.
great. Thank you. That's good. That's good. A couple of the other speakers have said they can't. But let's see if I can get the other panelists into the room and we can begin in a few moments.
Yes.
Other people using this, all the instructions are in German, which I don't speak, so I'm a little
Yeah.
confused. Yeah.
Okay, everybody. So thank you for those of you who have joined us here today. I can see we have two of our four panelists have managed to join. So we have today with us Fazila Mohammed from South Africa, and also Raparin, who is in Kurdish-led north and east Syria. I'm just going to take a couple of moments because we're trying to get our other two panelists into the group, so that we can hear from them as well, and we will get started in a couple of minutes. So thank you everybody for your patience. I think we need a couple of minutes for our guests to join us anyway, and we'll begin very soon. Okay, well, I'm just working on. I can see we've now got Thoreau. Okay, excellent. So I think we're managing to get underway here. I'm just going to Thoreau. I'm just going to send you an invitation, to speak, and I think maybe we can get started, pretty much now. I'm just trying to get our final panelist, Halzin, in to speak, who I know is up very late, in Australia, where I think it's 4 in the morning. So I hope we can manage to bring her voice in. But yeah, as we're managing to get speakers in and to join now, then Halsey, thank you for your patience, and I will just get the event underway, and then we can work on getting you in so we can make sure that we manage to hear from everyone today. So, without further ado, I'm very happy to begin this event for Ocalan Book Day. This is also World Human Rights Day. And of course, a day with many connotations across the world. But the Kurdish movement, Azlaq Bey Abdullah Öcalan, has also chosen to use this day to spotlight, on the one hand, the mistreatment of their leader, Abdullah Öcalan, who has been kept in conditions of solitary confinement, about which we'll hear more in the course of this discussion, I'm sure, for the best part of a quarter century. But in the course of that confinement, while attracting a lot of attention for his maltreatment, has also been able to advance a new political perspective based on quite unique principles of direct democracy, women's autonomy, and community inter-ethnic tolerance. And so I think the panelists today will do a good job of going a bit deeper on some of those subjects. So I know some of us are still having technical issues, so I think what I will do now is just invite our first speaker, and then I will try and fix that for those who are still struggling to join. So perhaps I can then, without further ado, invite our first guest, Raparin, from YPJ International, to speak in a moment. YPJ International is primarily Kurdish, but also inter-ethnic women's militia fighting in Kurdish-led north and east Syria, where they're trying to implement this political perspective that I've just discussed on a mass scale, uniting millions of people. As part of that, then many international volunteers have travelled to the region to join that process. And to lend their support to what they feel is a very unique and very vital political process being led by Öcalan, or being inspired, I should say, by Öcalan's ideas. So perhaps what I can do now is invite Raparin. Could you unmute your. Thank you. And would you like to? I believe you have some words that you'd like to share with us today. And while you do that, I'll work on getting the other people into the event. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I'm very honored to be here. I'm really glad that we're able to come together like this and discuss the thoughts of Abdullah Öcalan. So yeah, the text that I chose for today, it's not too long, it's about a page, and it's coming from actually not one of his more famous books, but it's actually an analysis of his from 1995. And it's in, I think, Kurdish and Turkish. And it hasn't yet been published in English. It's still being worked on, but in the spring there's going to be a publication that this is included inside it. And maybe people will be able to find this through genealogy in the spring. But yeah, I'll read a little passage from it and then we can discuss a bit about it. So this is an analysis by Abdullah Öcalan from February of 1995. Transitioning from the women's movement to the establishment of a women's army marks a crucial step toward liberation. Even in a broad sense, it is evident that in a society where men exclusively wield all the weapons, the balance inherently favors men. Globally, we recognize that armies constitute a fundamental source of political power, predominantly composed of men. The prevailing male dominance within the military not only symbolizes women's subordination, but also unmistakably mirrors their dominance in society, leaving no room for the assertion that dominance of men in the armed forces is detached from their overarching control in society. It's a reflection of a broader societal issue where male dominance contributes to the suppression of women. This pattern holds true not only for women, but but also for oppressed communities in general. A society with a powerful military tends to exert oppression over others. The concept of an army or military force operating under the principles of equality is non-existent. Armies do not exist where equality is present. They emerge where inequality prevails. One represents the oppressed, while the other symbolizes the oppressors. The continual presence of male-dominated armies indicates the stark reality of completely oppressed women. Life's realities confirm this observation. Therefore, even in a broad sense, we must recognize that women's armification signifies a fundamental value for equality. The term women's armification is chosen because it embodies the most fundamental tool for achieving equality. I'm not only talking about military armification. In economics and various social institutions, addressing the profound issues of equality and freedom is impossible without cultural women's armification, particularly in the field of culture. Observably, women whose societal roles have been severely restricted are generally discouraged from organizing and forming their own army due to their gender. Women have been excessively individualized, distanced from social, economic, political, and military organization, reducing them to mere individuals. In this state, women appear pitiful, emotional, submissive, begging, imploring, and tether themselves to men with cheap emotions out of compulsion. The imbalance and inequality creating by this permeate in all social institutions, including the family, fostering wars and inequalities in society. The organization and institutionalization of women's armification at every level are imperative for equality and freedom. Women's armification is the process through which women reclaim their gender identity. It involves gaining self-awareness, willpower, inner strength,
Hi, Reparine. You've just cut out there. Are you still able to hear us? Hi, Reparine. Are you still able to hear us? You just cut out for a moment there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry. Do you want to pick up where you left off? Thank you.
Where did it leave off? Do you remember?
Just go back a couple of sentences, and okay. I think we'll be fine. Thank you.
So, it's the last part of the text. Women's armification is the process through which women reclaim their gender identity. It involves gaining self-awareness, willpower, inner strength, standards of acceptance and refusal, rights to their identity, understanding of beauty and life force. It represents the freedom of gender, relationships, and life, a revival of lost love and beauty, and the elevation of stifled relationship levels to equal and free expressions. So this was the analysis of Serokati, of Abdullah Öcalan. That's a part of a longer analysis. It's just a small part that I took out. And yeah, there's a lot of big ideas here, so I thought maybe a few things I can open up a little bit. What he's talking about firstly here in the beginning is really the monopoly that men have over weapons, over military power, and over violence. So this means that patriarchy is actually in possession of all political power. And this reality, like this truth of male dominance in the military, is actually proving the male dominance in society. So he's explaining that where equality is existing, there's actually no armies. Like, armies are existing because of inequality. So actually, it's necessary for the oppressed party, which in this case is women, to claim their legitimate right of self-defense. And what he's proposing in this sense is a women's army. Now, this aspect particularly of self-defense is very important in that it's different from the violent arm of the state, that is its military, which is actually against society. But self-defense, in its essence, is existential. It's to protect freedom, it's to protect equality and democracy, which are actually, this is the essence of society. So one force is for society in life, and one force is actually against society. So to develop this kind of society, first we must defend its existence, which is under attack. So for this, he says a woman's army must be formed.
And when he says this word army, and he's talking about armification, he's not actually talking about just taking up arms, just picking up weapons. It's about women themselves as a gender becoming an army, becoming a unified force. So what does that mean? Like, what is an army? What does this word mean? What constitutes an army? And in what way does an army transcend the women's movement, like you mentioned in the beginning? Because the women's movement it's widespread. It's all over the world. But an army is something that's unified. It's clear, it's unbreakable, and each person in an army. Can you hear me still?
Yeah, sorry, yeah, just you dropped out again, but yeah, if you want to finish up what you were saying, we can hear you again. Thank you.
Okay. So I was saying, what is an army? What does this term mean? And how is it more than just women picking up weapons? So an army is something that's unified. It's something that's clear, it's unbreakable. Each person within an army is bound to each other by principles, by standards, and this creates a unified front against the oppressors. So for women, that means, for example, in an army, it means fighting together as women for women against a common enemy for existence and life. It's not just women in a military fighting a man's war. This is already existing in the world, and it's meaningless. But a women's army is something that has a completely different meaning. It takes a different shape. But the military is just one example. Women's armification in itself is actually what he's talking about here is in all fields of life. It refers to the unity and the power of women, not just with weapons. So he says women must be an army in all social spheres as well. Because without the existence of this unity of women, inequality will always be existing there. So this means economy, it means agriculture, it means politics, it means culture and arts. It also means self-defense. So in all of these spheres, this is the armification that he's talking about. And if we see throughout history, what's happened is that women were forced to become disconnected from each other. They were forced to be disconnected from land and from nature, and they became individuals. They were individualized, and individuals can more easily be conquered. A woman alone is cut off, actually, from her true essence, which is sociality. It's community, it's society itself. So what he's saying here is that women must regain this aspect of their own truths. And through this, freedom will also be brought to all of the reaches of society itself. So again, thank you for allowing me to bring this piece of the talk of Abdullah Öcalan to everyone today.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Rapareen, for joining us and for sharing that. And perhaps later on, I will also have some more questions about, you know, your day-to-day experience at the moment in those Kurdish-led regions, those regions inspired by the thought of Abdullah Öcalan, and how some of these ideas are kind of played out and experienced on the ground. But I think now would be a good point to invite our second speaker. And I'm very excited because not only have we been able to hear from someone active within the Kurdish women's movement, but today we're also joined by Fazela Mohammed, speaking to us from South Africa. And Fazela is an activist with many, many years experience in that country's own liberation movement, which shares, you know, a common history and many ideological, political, and even personal ties with the Kurdish movement. So Fazela, could I invite you to unmute your microphone? And perhaps you'd like to share with us some of your thoughts on this International Human Rights Day, on the way in which the Kurdish struggle is reflected in the South African struggle and vice versa. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. I'm really going to talk to you a bit about, the way we built our movement, the struggle for freedom in South Africa, and the parallels between the incarceration of Mandela and Öcalan. So You know, for me, I was active right from the late 70s right through to the 80s until the banning of the political movements in South Africa in 1990. And I just want to reflect a bit on the Free Mandela campaign and its parallels with the, you know, the campaign for the release of Ocalan. As you know, the campaign to free Mandela originated after the ANC was banned in 1960, you know, after the Sharpeville massacre, in a similar way, you know, and the ANC then decided to take up armed struggle to resist the apartheid enemy. In the same way, you know, the PKK was banned, and they too then decided, you know, after a massacre, to take up the armed struggle. So I think that in that way, we see the parallel, the right for oppressed people to resist in every form, you know, injustice and inequality. And I think that the Kurdish people have that same right and struggle on their hands. You know, when Mandela was incarcerated, and in fact, even before his incarceration, the ANC decided that a big component of its struggle was to create international support for Mandela and the mass detentions that were happening at the time. You know, so like every other repressive state, the apartheid government decided that its way to silence the voices of the people is to put them in jail, and to silence the voice of the leaders of the movements that were being led. So in the same way that Ocalan was, you know, became wanted, in the same way Mandela was hunted down, you know, and similarly, like Ocalan's incarceration, international agencies were involved. We know that the CIA was instrumental in giving the racist government information related to Mandela's whereabouts and had him arrested. In the same way, the CIA, Mossad, and other intelligence, the Turkish intelligence, received information on Ocalan's whereabouts and had him arrested. So as you can see, these leaders, not only are they part of an individual country's struggle, but also they reflect the global cooperation you know, against people seeking freedom. We see it very clearly in this time. So I think that for us, that is an important lesson that we learned. Then, of course, the incarceration of Mandela happened at a time when Africa was getting its freedom all over. And there was a huge political support from anti-colonial, you know, from all anti-colonial leaders who had just completed their struggles, and it was a different time. But Mandela became the vision and the voice of the South African people under apartheid, in the same way as Ocalan is the voice and the vision of the people, of the Kurdish people. So for us, it's almost like a no-brainer. We can just see the immediate parallels. Of course, Mandela too was regarded as a terrorist. I mean, it was very late, even after he became president, when he, you know, when he initially applied to the United States and Canada to visit, they had to remove him from the list of the terrorists before they allowed him in. So I think, you know, this notion of naming people and putting them on lists and preventing them from speaking on behalf of the people is a way that repressive governments silence people. So I think that for us in South Africa, we understand struggles for freedom because we are so close to it, and it just happened recently in our lifetime. So we take inspiration from our own struggle, and we hope to inspire others that, you know, even in the darkest of times, there always will be hope. And the more the enemy persists in repressing people, the greater the cause will be. So that is really what I want to say as an introduction, and then perhaps we can proceed after that with some questions.
Yes, thank you, Fazela. And well, maybe I think Dr. Thoreau Redcrow from the Kurdish Center for Studies, who has also joined us today, well, would like to say a few words in response to that. Maybe you can just respond now, Thoreau, as it's fresh in people's memories.
Okay, yes, thank you, Fazela, for that. Earlier I spoke at a book day event as well, and we also drew this parallel to Nelson Mandela and the idea that if you look at how, you know, for 18 of the 27 years, apartheid South Africa had Nelson Mandela on Robben Island, you know, similarly, obviously, to how Abdullah Öcalan is being kept on Imrali Island. And it's very interesting when you go back and look at the way that the British press describes Mandela through the late 60s, you know, or 70s and 80s. And you can almost just switch out the word Mandela for Öcalan for a lot of these epithets and propaganda and the heinous way that they described Mandela. And then immediately when South African apartheid was crumbling and they thought that, you know, it would be beneficial to release him, how quickly the Western world switches and all of them pretend that they didn't criminalize him, that they didn't say all of these bad things about him. And he kind of becomes a cause celeb at the United Nations and the world and an ambassador for peace and all of these things. And they count on people forgetting and this sort of historical amnesia of the population, not realizing the way that they had criminalized him and were fine with him being kept in isolation on an island in the same way they are Abdullah Öcalan today. So we were discussing earlier at the event here where I said, you know, in a hypothetical world where Abdullah Öcalan was released from prison onto house arrest and he opened into a negotiation with the Turkish state and a peace agreement was reached and he got a Nobel Peace Prize and one of the Turkish leaders also did as well. And the entire international community would, you know, delist the PKK and they would pretend that they had never criminalized the Kurdish movement, that they had never aided in the destruction of 4,000 Kurdish villages and the death squads and all of the cruelty and torture that the West has armed and abetted and been a part of. They would pretend all of that never occurred. So I'm glad that you brought up that parallel and it really spoke to me as well.
Yeah, thank you very much, Thoreau. And I'd like to invite certainly all of our panelists, if you would like to respond to one another's contributions or the passages that you've brought to share today, you're very welcome to do so. And for those who are listening as well, if you would like to make a contribution, you can just send us a tweet at this account with your question, or you can send me a request to speak and we'll try to get to some of those a little bit later on. I can see some familiar faces in the chat with us today. So yeah, you'll also be welcome to put a question or a comment. I don't know, maybe either Halcine or Thoreau, I know you've both brought passages as well to share today. So if you're ready, Halcine, as I know you've had some struggles getting into the space today. I'm very glad that you've taken the time to join us and to share your perspective as you know, a leading Kurdish academic currently based in Australia, hence the punishing time difference. And if you would like to share what the passage you've brought with you today, we'd be very happy to hear your contribution as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So I do apologize. I did have some technical issues and I did miss the first part of the discussion. So I'm jumping in slightly blind. But the passage that I chose, I mean, it's very, very difficult to choose a passage out of the wealth of knowledge that Abdullah Öcalan has contributed to our understanding of society and freedom and gender and democracy. But I went back to the first time when I was being introduced to the writings of Abdullah Öcalan, and I came back to the pamphlet Liberating Life, Women's Revolution, which was published by the International Initiative Edition. And I've chosen a passage from page 10 to 11 on that, and you can find Liberating Life, Women's Revolution very easily online for those who are trying to get to know Öcalan's writing a little bit better. So the passage goes, and obviously this is going to be about gender because it is obviously about women's revolution. He goes, "The history of the loss of freedom is at the same time the history of how women lost her position and vanished from history. It is the history of how the dominant male, with all his gods and servants, rulers and subordinates, his economy, science and arts obtained power. Woman's downfall and loss is thus the downfall and loss of the whole of society, while the resultant sexist society. The sexist male is so keen on constructing his social dominance over woman that he turns any contact with her into a show of dominance." What a powerful start. Then he goes on to say, the depth of women's enslavement and the intentional masking of this fact is thus closely linked to the rise within a society of hierarchical and statist power. As women are habituated to slavery, hierarchies are established. The path to the enslavement of the other sections of society is paved. The enslavement of men comes after the enslavement of women. The enslavement of men comes after the enslavement of women. This is very, very, very powerful. Gender enslavement is different in some ways to class and national nation enslavement. Its legitimization is attained through refined and intense repression combined with lies that play on emotion. Woman's biological difference is used as justification for her enslavement. All the work she does is taken for granted and called unworthy woman's work. Her presence in the public sphere is claimed to be prohibited by religion, morally shameful. Progressively, she is secluded from all important social activities. As the dominant power of the political, social, and economic activities are taken over by the men, the weakness of the woman becomes even more institutionalized. Thus, the idea of a weak sex becomes a shared belief. And then he begins to conclude this passage by saying, in fact, society treats women not merely as a biologically separate sex, but almost as a separate race, nation, or class, the most oppressed race, nation, or class. No race, class, or nation is subjected to such systematic slavery as housewifeization. And that is mind-blowing. As an academic who has spent the last basically 10 years focusing on feminist ideology and theory, there is no feminist theory developed in the Western world that can come close to what has been written here. We've seen the utter and total failure of liberal white feminism. We have seen the contribution of Black women and women of color and women from the third world trying to catch up and fill some of the gaps that white feminism within all its different spheres and zones of contribution have, produced. But nothing has stated something as strong and as powerfully as what we are seeing here produced by Abdullah Öcalan. And as a feminist, there have been some criticism when I've raised some of these issues, you know, some of these discussions around gender that Öcalan produces, that how can a man produce a liberation ideology for women? It should be the voice of women. It should be women who are affected by some of these issues that are being, you know, experienced by women on their daily lives. But I think if we go back and look at the life of Öcalan and we see his utter, he's consumed with the idea of liberation. And this liberation isn't a patriarchal status, top-down form of liberation. It is a liberation that comes from the oppressed, from the very bottom layers of society, from the grassroots level. And he comes to the conclusion that no society can be free until the women are liberated. So he does something incredibly powerful, incredibly revolutionary, something that we've never seen to date. And that is to say that if a nation such as the Kurds or any other group are aspiring towards freedom, they can never actually achieve that freedom unless the women are first liberated. And that is absolutely revolutionary and a radical disconnect from the liberation ideologies that we've seen produced so far. So I'll stop there. I'm not sure how much I should go on, Matt.
Thank you very much, Hazin. I'm really glad you could join and share in these words, which clearly mean so much to you and to so many others, and to put into words a bit how transformative and how exciting they are. I know I certainly have some follow-up questions I would like to put in a moment to yourself and to the other panelists, linking together some of these contributions we've heard today. Perhaps, though, we should just now invite Dr. Thoreau Redcrow, also a co-director of the Kurdish Centre for Studies, who I know has also brought a contribution today. And again, to all of our other listeners, please do feel free to send a request to speak or simply just send a tweet to the Medjay News account with your own questions or your own contributions, and we'll get to some of those shortly. But Dr. Redcrow, perhaps I can invite you now to share your own contribution that you've prepared for this Öcalan Book Day event. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I will share a passage from Beyond State Power and Violence, a passage that I actually had translated with a friend of mine, because I actually prefer to get the translated versions, and then go from the direct book version, but it's very similar. So to begin the passage, he says, "I still have to address a methodological problem. Modern, i.e. Sumerian priests of the West, such as writers, philosophers, scientists, and artists of various schools, study a phenomenon, an event or process by breaking its entirety and analyzing the parts. They believe that research is only possible when its subject is reduced to the position of a cadaver and dissected. This always reminds me of the methods used by the Sumerian priests to read people's fate from the movements of the stars. One is regarded as science, the other called mythology. But in my opinion, the result is the same."
Hi, Thoreau. I think you've just, your audio has just dropped out there. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
can you hear me? Yeah, do you want to just go back a couple of lines and pick up where you left off? Thank you.
Okay. This always reminds me of the methods used by the Sumerian priests to read people's fate from the movements of the stars. One is regarded as science, the other called mythology. But in my opinion, they result in the same. I'm even convinced that the actions of our, so to say, quote-unquote modern priests are far more ethically questionable. Why, despite all of the detailed knowledge, cannot they understand the physical and intellectual campaigns of annihilation of the 20th century, which far exceed those of all other centuries? Why can't they offer effective solutions? No phenomenon, event, or process can be correctly defined without applying a holistic view. The reductionist approach in an analysis, which is the process of breaking something into separate pieces, pushes the truth into the background. It is not an educational approach, but actually prevents sensible learning. The capitalist system of the West has destroyed the wholeness of existence through excessive fragmentation and alteration. This is
Hi, Thoreau. I'm afraid you've just cut out again there. Apologies for these audio bugs. Are you able to hear me to finish off sharing your contribution?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thank you. Yes. Yeah, let's try once more to finish this off. Thank you.
All right. Sorry about that. The capitalist system of the West has destroyed the wholeness of existence through excessive fragmentation and alteration. That is the reason why the system is in a social crisis. Art, philosophy, and science have an undeniable effect on the mental state of mankind. You cannot take the human mind or spirituality and rip it into pieces, because dismembering effectively kills. In the West, this is the dominant way of killing, and it is being extended to the whole world. The most important aspect of human wisdom is that it represents wholeness. All perversion ultimately stems from a lack of holistic understanding. It is massacring reality. It is the disease of the era of the system. The view that is considered particularly scientific should be viewed as the most insidious form of ignorance. The blind belief in a science that has no spirituality whatsoever has lost its emotional intelligence and only relies on uncontrolled calculating intelligence. It is extremely dangerous in every respect. Our age has destroyed the continuity of holistic knowledge.
I think we are getting a little bit broken up with Thoreau's contribution there, unfortunately. So maybe we'll just give that 5 minutes for.
Yeah, can you hear me? Or
we can hear you again.
I don't know. Did it break out?
Can I give a piece of advice? Because I noticed this was also happening to me when I was speaking.
Okay.
Whenever the phone screen turns off. Also, the microphone stops working. So as long as your phone screen is still open, then it should be okay.
Okay, yeah, I think it's just mine. I'm not sure exactly why it's cutting out. But to sort of finish, there's just two paragraphs left, but I'll go back one, I guess. Our age has destroyed the continuity of holistic knowledge, which defines social existence. This is also why science is so destructive. Nuclear destruction, for example, is the symbolic expression of a reality. The fact that man uses the atomic bomb against himself is no less cruel than cannibalism. Actually, the task of social sciences would be to avoid analytical fragmentation and preserve wholeness. Instead, they themselves continue to break down into branches and thus turn it into an actual source of danger. As a result, countless local, regional, and global wars, nationalism, fascism, and all kinds of violence ensue. This is why, in the defense, I have tried to fuse religion, mythology, philosophy, science, and literature into a harmonious mental attitude. This is the only way to defend peoples and the essence of humanity. How powerful a defense is ultimately depends on the extent to which it is able to. So yes, that's the passage. I don't know if I'm still, if you can still hear me okay, but.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes, I think the passage, you know, obviously I read a longer passage, but I think it, you know, it speaks to this idea of the widespread nature of Ocalan's ideas, where he is both sort of revolutionary, but philosopher, sociologist, historian, economist, anthropologist almost. It's almost difficult to describe all of the various hats that he wears in his analysis and in his writings, because essentially the time on Imrali Island prison is giving him spare time to read books and, you know, do the equivalent of a dissertation every couple of years while he's, you know, in isolation, jailed on this island. And so he is able to reach out into so many different aspects that I think are important to understand, because many of these are seen usually in fragmentation. To use an analogy, it's like looking at a church ceiling with a flashlight versus a candle. The average, most of this analysis is someone holding a flashlight up to the church ceiling. So you see one little.
Hi, Thoreau. I'm afraid you have cut out once again. Okay. It seems every time I ask, then you then manage to get back on. Yep. So apologies for that.
Yeah. No, I think you basically heard me. I think I just ended with the idea that I used the example of you know, a church ceiling and using a flashlight. You know, most analysis is a flashlight on the church ceiling, but what Ocalan does is he brings a candle into the end of the church, and so it illuminates the entire ceiling in maybe a lesser bit of light, but it allows you to see how all the parts connect together. So that's why I believe it's helpful to read his books and his writings.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, it's an interesting image, and certainly, yeah, the experience of reading some of these books is quite unique and somewhat different to other political texts that people might be familiar with, and that's part of why, you know, that kind of elusive almost quality that it has to his writing can be particularly illuminating and inspiring for many people across the world. I know I have some follow-up questions, well, follow-up questions for everyone really, but I did just want to come back to some thoughts from the contribution that Dr. Housing Aziz was making, and then put a question to Fazela on that basis, because Housing talked, you know, sort of very powerfully and slightly personally about the extent to which, you know, Ocalan, despite being a male leader, has been able to inspire, you know, so many female militants, female activists, women in their communities throughout Kurdistan to sort of take on his ideas and give them a new form and a new life through their organization as women. And so I wanted to ask maybe both Reparin and Fazela about that. But maybe Fazela, first of all, I could invite you to just speak a bit about your experiences as a woman in the South African liberation movement. What did Mandela mean to you as South African women, and how did women play a particular role in that struggle?
Well, the women were involved in South Africa from quite an early stage, because actually women were one of the first victims of apartheid. You know, you may be aware that in South Africa, Black people's movement within the country was very restricted, and women were confined to the rural areas, and men used to come to the mines to work. And ultimately, women were not allowed to join and families were not allowed to be together. So women bore the brunt of like abject poverty in the rural areas and restricted movement, etc. So it was the women who initially, you know, fought against the pass laws in South Africa, as we call them. And we in South Africa always said that we suffer from triple levels of oppression. The first is oppression as women. The second is oppression under apartheid, and then oppression, you know, in a patriarchy. So we always said that women suffer from three levels of oppression, and the voices of South African women were heard in the struggle. Of course, you know, the women's movement in South Africa had a critique of Western feminism, which actually, you know, looked at women under capitalism and their exploitation under capitalism. So I think the struggle for women, while not maybe clearly articulated by Mandela, but, you know, I think that the struggle of women was one of the top, you know, in our society, we always said that women suffered the most levels of oppression. And so, yes, but I think that we have a lot to learn from the Kurdish struggle and the role in which women are given. I think that what they try to do now in South Africa to empower women is to play a numbers game, you know, whether it should be 50-50 in a list, whether it should be, I think at the moment, one third of all lists in elected government should be women. And, you know, some, of course, a lot of people are saying that it should be 50-50. But it's a numbers game instead of actually qualitatively enhancing the role of women in like important decision making. So if you take political movements, most of the movement, political parties in South Africa, most of the top, you know, what we call normally in South Africa, the top five are mainly men in all, you know, in all political formations. And there's a huge push against that because for women to be integral, to be of the part of the decision making is really critical. So, yeah, but I think that we have a lot to learn from you know, how the Kurdish women have taken their role in their movements.
Thank you, Fazela. I'm very glad that you're here with us today, and it's very interesting to hear some of your reflections on those long decades of ongoing, as you mentioned, struggle in South Africa for the particular emancipation of women and the challenges they face. Maybe now we can then come back again to Reparine, who is speaking to us from Kurdistan. And I don't know, yeah, either if you want to respond to what Fazela has just shared, and if you see any similarities with the situation there in Kurdistan, and also, yeah, maybe in general about how you kind of see some of these ideas we've been talking about today animating women's political organization and women's everyday life in Kurdistan.
Yeah, sure. So I think something that I'm really starting to see a strong theme, both in this text that I brought today, but also in coming to Kurdistan and really, really understanding on a much deeper level things in practicality instead of just in theory, is this idea of women's organization, of women's autonomy, what it actually means and what it looks like in practice and what it feels like and what kind of society it builds, you know? Because in theory, there is a lot of writings, there's a lot of readings, there's a lot of discussions we can have, but being able to experience it and to see it on a widespread and institutionalized level is something very different. So I think, yeah, what's important here, and why I also wanted to bring this text today, is because to understand this idea of women's armification is what he said. Armification is—it's not just military. It's the same way that actually the YPG, or the women's military in Rojava, has been so, I want to even say, glorified in the media. It's become very popular all over the world. Now people are seeing it, and it's also very inspirational for sure. It's very inspirational. But the same way that the women are organized in the military here, which is what's the most seen, is actually also existing in every level of society. So this women's autonomy and this level of women's organization is in all institutions. And it's not just women who are becoming revolutionaries. It's not just women
laying down their lives. It's all of the women have this opportunity now. So I think, the way that Ocalan's ideas have shaped the society here it's very crucial, because the entire revolution is based on these ideas, and not just in a theoretical way, but in a very practical way, because they've been institutionalized. You know, before the revolution, and even in the beginning of the revolution, and even now, it's still existing a bit, because it's a long-term struggle. No, it doesn't just happen overnight. But women were not able to participate in different institutions because they were very dominated by men. Different social institutions, military for sure, military not. On one hand, they didn't have they felt shame, they felt inadequacy. All of these things were imposed on them socially. They were not existing in public spheres. But this level still remained very individual. Now, if women could find the individual strength to overcome these feelings of shame and inadequacy, maybe they can assert themselves in these different fields of life. But what's really important that's happening in Kurdistan is that it's not an individual problem that women have to overcome. The society itself has changed. The foundations of the society has changed, so that the ability for women to participate and to be leaders in all of these aspects of society becomes possible, because it's institutionalized now. So it's no longer an individual thing. It's so organized, and the women have become so organized that now it's become a wide-scale reality for many women, for mothers, for workers, for students. Any woman that is existing here can take full participation in their own liberation. And this is something that's very beautiful.
Thank you. Hazim, would you like to follow on from that?
Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Raparin, for that wonderful analysis. I'd like to contribute to what Raparin said and link it back to what Fazila said in relation to what women, non-Kurdish women in other societies, in oppressed societies, can do to try to emulate the kind of revolutionary social progress and change that Kurdish women have been able to produce in places such as in Rojava. And as Raparin so beautifully mentioned, it's the institutionalization of change and progress within society that has been so profound and fundamental in ensuring that women have a wider voice in society, in the political, economic, social, environmental, every sphere of life. In the passage that I read, you know, Ocalan really highlights the way in which women are oppressed. And later on, he goes on to say that in order for society to be free, in order for men to be free, in order for collective democratization, for happiness, for justice, for peace to occur, women need to be liberated. And in order for that to happen, there needs to be a total divorce. This is in Ocalan's words, a total divorce in the way, you know, between these 5,000 years old traditions and patriarchal and male-dominated society and values, and these gender essentialists, the ways in men are defined by their biological, men and women are defined by their biological positions. And so what we've seen through the institutionalization of change is women such as the Yepeja, who have really challenged these foundation of what women are able to do. Now, forming a military or an organization such as the Yepeja, it's not new in itself. Women have always organized, they've always participated in military movements, in nationalist revolutions, in the struggle to liberate their people. That in itself is not new. But what is new is the ideology behind that liberation, the ideology that underpins what, for example, the Yepeja does in society or in Rojava, in their fight against ISIS, in their fight against the status oppression from places, countries such as Turkey, the ideology of the liberation of women, the ideology that women have a fundamental right to liberate themselves, that they must struggle, they must organize, and this organization is very, very, very important in order for them to be able to produce wholesale, widespread liberation. And part of that organization, part of that institutionalization comes from this fundamental important step that is taken that Ocalan really advocates repeatedly in his writing, and that is the importance of ideological education, or in the Kurdish words, parwada. So as Raperin so, you know, wonderfully mentioned, these women, whether they're young girls, 15, 16-year-olds, whether they're 60 or 70-year-old women, whether they're housewives, whether they're engineers or teachers or students or across all spheres of life, these women are collectively, periodically enter into these education, into these parwada seminars, and they are educated about the long history of patriarchy, about colonialism, about capitalism, about environmentalism, about different ideologies that have come together to create an umbrella of oppression, this patriarchal capitalist status system that oppresses women. And so when we have the Yapaje, they have this dual mentality, this attitude, this perspective and goal that one, we need to liberate ourselves from this patriarchal statist, hierarchical statist oppression or capitalist oppression. And this needs to be done by actively protesting and fighting and resisting the state and its institutions of power and the branches of violence that it produces. But also this needs to be a personal internal struggle as well within the communities, within the Kurdish community, for example. So it's not enough just to form a women's liberation movement, women's protection, and we're struggling against ISIS and we're struggling against the bombardments of Turkey. What are we doing every single day to challenge these patriarchal, hierarchical, traditional conservative values within our families, within our communities? And this is where organizations and institutions such as the, you know, the Congressta, women's houses, the co-chair system, the gender 60 to 40% quota, women's cooperatives, women's councils all come together to create reinforcing sort of branches within society across all spheres of societies that reproduces, reinforces, and entrenches women's empowerment. I think I'll stop there because, yes, I'll stop there.
Thank you, Halzin. So I would, if any of the other speakers would like to respond on those comments, we can keep this conversation going. If not, I also have a couple more questions I'd like to get to before we close.
Can I just comment?
Please.
You know, it's quite interesting because in the last year or two, there was, in South Africa, you know, the women's movement made a lot of advance, you know, for women's rights in South Africa, etc. But 30 years after democracy, you know, when the constitution was written, there was a huge discussion on the role of traditional leaders in South Africa. And there was a very conscious effort that, you know, the powers given to traditional leaders must not undermine women's rights. And in the last year, you know, the traditional leaders have demanded more recognition for the role they play in society, etc., and demanding more rights. The outcome of that was actually, you know, so giving them much more formal powers actually then meant that women's rights as enshrined in the constitution were undermined. Because they, you know, in traditional societies in South Africa, the traditional leaders, there are some head traditional leaders who are women in, you know, some of the provinces, but by and large, they're men. And, you know, so the inheritance rights of women when their husbands die, etc., it will take that work back 50 years for us. So, you know, there are pushes and pulls, and I mean, you can... You know, I mean, the tradition, the Congress tradition in South Africa, and I mean, in the last 20, 30 years, the advances made by the women's movement, you know, can be pushed back. So also there's a need for ever vigilance and kind of mobilization of women to make sure that these wins are not kind of, you know, reduced. This is just from my experience in South Africa.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, that you say that, Fazela, because I think it's very similar to one of the major challenges which is facing the Kurdish-led political project in northern Syria today is kind of very similar about reconciling with a slightly different character maybe, but they're, you know, they are also trying to devolve decision making ability and democratic power to the people, and often that means working with traditional communities built around more or less patriarchal tribal structures, and there's always a real difficult balancing act to be undertaken in terms of, you know, we want to devolve power to this community and give this community the power to determine their own future, but maybe those who are able to make their voices heard in that community are not those who have women's best interests at heart. And so there have been and are still very difficult kind of workings out in practice of how this democratic vision can be implemented while still ensuring the respect for minority rights and particularly for women's rights and women's opportunities for emancipation. There's just a couple, there's sort of two more questions I would really like to get to, one from myself, and we've had one question submitted from the floor, which I'll be happy to put to our speakers, and perhaps we'll finish up in the next 10-15 minutes or so. So yeah, with that in mind, again, you know, the panelists are very welcome to keep responding to one another as they have been. I would just like to put another question into the mix, which is, I suppose, whether Öcalan's ideas that we've spoken about today can have relevance beyond the situation in Kurdistan, and if so, how? You know, we've spoken about, you know, the Kurdish struggle and the Kurdish women's struggle is not something which occurs in a vacuum, and which has ways in which it's similar and ways in which it correlates to ongoing struggles throughout the Global South and women's struggles. Are there ways in which these very sometimes very different struggles can be linked up and connected and made into more of a global movement? And I don't know if perhaps Raparin from YPJ or one of the other speakers would like to say a few words on that.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah, this is a very nice question. I can say a few things. I think also maybe some of the other panelists can add a bit. But from understanding the history of the movement here, which is quite a long history now, we see that actually the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan from the beginning and in their essence, really in the core of the ideas, are actually international. And I don't just mean that they're like catered to an international perspective, but actually the ideas themselves are for a democratic world. Just the same way as how capitalism and patriarchy are global entities that are constructing modern civilization. Also the solution to this modernity has to be global. This democracy, this democratic solution must also be global. And it's the same way for women's freedom. The women's freedom that we're discussing a lot today, and that's discussed for many, many years by Abdullah Öcalan and by the women here as well, it's not just for the women in North and East Syria. It's not just for the women in Kurdistan. Women's liberation and women's armification, it's necessary to overcome patriarchy everywhere. And also we can see, if we look at this revolution from the beginning, we have many, many international martyrs. And the international character of the revolution really is exponentially growing. It's growing so much bigger. And as the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan are becoming spread and more well-known in all parts of the globe. And I think this is because people, they really see themselves in his ideas. You know, how else could a young woman from South Asia or an older woman from Canada join the struggle with so much enthusiasm? We see, like I said, there are so many international martyrs from the beginning of the struggle, not just from Europe and North and South America, also from the Middle East, also many other women from different parts of the Middle East are coming and are joining the struggle here. And we can see that it's also not just, it's not a national liberation struggle, and it's not just a revolutionary moment in time. It's something that's much larger. It's where it's a place that people are not just coming and fighting and joining the struggle and giving solidarity and then returning to their countries again, but it's actually a place that connections are being made from all around the globe that are building a force that can combat imperialism and colonialism. So in this, people see themselves
and they give themselves to the struggle because it's a shared struggle for life itself. I mean, if we really understand deeply the ideology, we can even say that the plants and the animals are on our side. And that's more than international. It's interspecies, because this is also their struggle. It's a liberation. Liberation itself is for life. And this is the thing that's all connecting us. This is the struggle towards life and towards truth. So this is what I can say about this topic.
Thank you, Raparine, for sharing those. A hopeful perspective from amid very difficult circumstances in northern Syria. We have a question from the floor from Sarah Glynn, who is a long-term campaigner and prominent voice on these issues. Sarah, would you like to share your question?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Perfect. So we've heard a lot about we've had two readings of Öcalan on the role of women. But I think one of the most interesting contributions that he makes to this is actually on the role of men. And you know, it's obviously related. And perhaps also separating things that we've always associated with women, that men can also think that way, that they don't have to be so separated. So I was wondering if the people who've commented and with these wonderful readings about the role of women could also say a little bit about what Öcalan has to tell us about what it means to be a man, or what it could mean to be a man, should mean to be a man.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, I've heard this question debated at great length myself in Kurdistan. But yeah, perhaps, so it's a very interesting question, and perhaps, Halseen, would you like to say something on this?
Thank you, Matt, and thank you, Sarah, for that very, very thought-provoking question. Öcalan has a lot to say about the role and position of men within society. There's a wonderful quote where he says, "Man has to overcome always seeing woman as wife, sister, or lover, stereotypes forged by tradition and modernity." So although we've spoken a lot about the role of women in relation to self-liberation and collective liberation, Öcalan also places significant responsibility on the shoulders of men to unlearn the ways in which they have been taught by tradition and patriarchy and the statist capitalist system to always become oppressors. And he has this wonderful statement about killing the dominant male, killing the toxic masculinity within men. And so he challenges men to be self-critical, to be self-critical of the ways in which they've been educated within the capitalist patriarchal system. And so when I mentioned earlier in relation to education and parwarda, the men are encouraged just as much as the women to sit side by side together in these educational seminars and to learn and to unlearn, to actively unlearn what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman. So he actually challenges both men and women. And I think in the example of Öcalan himself as a revolutionary, as a philosopher, as a sociologist, as somebody who has dedicated his life to the collective liberation of society, but also specifically to that of women, he sets a very, very profound example for men to follow, that to be liberated. Can you hear me, Matt? Am I speaking to the void?
We can hear you. Yeah, we can hear you perfectly.
Okay, sorry, I just lost track of thoughts. But he you know, creates this wonderful example in himself by asking men to unlearn what they have been taught by these traditions and the capitalist patriarchal system. So the man needs to unlearn what he has been taught, and he can actually become a leader side by side alongside women. And remember, this society that we are envisioning is not some utopian feminist system where men are pushed into the background, men have no voice. No, it's about equality, it's about justice, it's about looking at different spheres of society and being able to determine where a male voice is important, or where a female voice is more important, where a dual voice is more important. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I have maybe one more question from the floor we'll take in a moment. I don't know if any of our other panelists, if Raparine, if you want to say anything more on that question.
No, I think the answer from the other panelists was very insightful, and I'm looking forward to what the other panelists have to say.
Thank you. Well, let me then just, I'll put this final question that I think, yeah, yourself, Raparine, or Halcine, you could possibly give some input on, and we'll then hear a final word from hopefully all of our panelists before we close. And so we have a question saying, it's been said on the panel that Öcalan's ideas are growing and spreading and being adopted, but how do we measure that? So I think, yeah, they're asking what is, you know, what's kind of the real world manifestation that, you know, these ideas are being implemented. So yeah, I don't know if one of our panelists would like to say a few words on that.
I can speak if I'm not overstepping.
Sure, thank you.
I think what we've seen, as Raparine mentioned, we've seen a lot of internationals, we've seen a lot of Kurds, we've seen people from Europe, America, Canada, Australia, from the outside world, from the diaspora, going into Kurdistan and participating in these educational and ideological parwazes and learning. We've seen groups sitting, you know, book clubs formed to study and analyze Öcalan's writings and works. We've seen more understanding and awareness of the Kurdish liberation movement and what, and you know, the project that is being implemented in Rojava. So I think there's quite a lot of global awareness of Öcalan's writing. How deep that awareness is, I think the responsibility of individuals like us who have gone into these, you know, gone into places like Rojava, who have participated in the Parwada and have left and are now situated in the diaspora. I think there is, despite the bleakness of the current global situation, despite the multiple genocides and oppressions that are occurring, despite the ongoing feminicides that is occurring against women across all spheres of society, there is still much, much hope. And I think that's what Öcalan's writing teaches us, that there's always space for radical hope, that we must always imagine something different, that we must always challenge ourselves first as individuals, and then our families, our communities, our partners, our places of work, and our collective societies, because we must envision that something better can be produced. Because if we can't envision that something better can be produced, then what is the point of all of this? And I think we've seen through the radical example of Rojava in being bombarded by ISIS, being destroyed and having airstrikes constantly and targeted by Turkey, NATO's second largest army, the constant challenges that are being faced, the humanitarian crises that are ongoing, the annexation of Serikanya and Afrin, we see Rojava still breathing, and she's still breathing, and she's still trying to produce this wonderful, imperfect, it is absolutely imperfect, you know, revolution, but the fact that she's still struggling and the fact that she's still breathing and she's still producing this radical democratic model, I think should be the inspiration that should drive us to do better for ourselves and for our communities, for our families and for our societies, and most importantly, for the future generations.
Thank you very much, Halcine, for sharing those words. It's been really great to hear these contributions from all of our speakers today. And in a moment, I'm just going to invite them to share some closing reflections on one another's contributions briefly. Just before I do that, I also have a text which I was going to share some from today. I'll just share like a couple of sentences, as there's been a lot to chew on already. But I think it's a particularly useful text that we can look at today, especially as we've been thinking about the links with the South African struggle as well. And it's a text in which Öcalan reflects on his own detention and how that kind of correlates to the treatment of repressed peoples all over the world. And he says, "Prisons are not correctional centres, but places where one also learns to adequately fulfil moral duty against society. Just the same applies to freedom fighters in the mountains. Being a freedom fighter means performing one's moral and political duties related to society at the highest possible level. It means being in a conscious moral duty. It means fulfilling the requirements of self-defense toward liberation. Since human life only makes sense when it's free, no matter where it is lived without freedom, it is always a dark dungeon." And I think there's a lot that could be said about that passage, but I think it really does really bring out, maybe the links between this one case and this one set of ideas that we've been talking about today and broader global issues and global struggles. And so, yeah, maybe I'd just quite simply like to invite all of our panelists to say, you know, sort of a couple of lines of the thoughts they would like our listeners today to take away with them as they go out into a world where we're seeing so much nationalist, patriarchal, statist violence playing out day by day. Fazela, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really wonderful to have your contributions. Are there any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
Well, the passage you just read out is really clearly an indication that, it expresses the South African case clearly. But just to say also that in the struggle, these things take time, the advancement of women's rights, the fundamental freedoms we all fight for, etc. It takes time, but with time also, we can learn from each other. There's lots of lessons from South Africa, which I think, and mistakes that we have learned, and we can learn from the struggles of the Kurdish people, in particular the role. I think that there's a quite an important role that the women, the Kurdish women, can show South African women also to advance their own cause. Because right now, a lot of the women, people who participate, women who participate in politics, it's about, personal glory, getting into the political system, getting into the party system, and actually sacrificing ultimately the role of women, enhancing the role of women in society. So I think that there's a lot to be learned. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And perhaps while this microphone seems to be working, Dr. Thoreau Redcrow, would you like to share some final thoughts?
Yes, thank you. I apologize for all the technical difficulties I seem to be having. But I would say first, I would have a cautionary message to the Turkish state itself, not to let the opportunity of negotiating with Öcalan pass, because he really is the indispensable person in this scenario, where he's the only person who can negotiate a peace treaty with the Turkish state that will be upheld and that will be honored, because he's the only person that has the sort of gravitas and the communal respect amongst the Kurdish people that he can sign it and it will be obeyed and agreed to. And if something were to happen to him, or if he were to pass away, there is no other Öcalan, in the foreground. There is no person who can achieve peace in the way that he can. And by locking him away on Imrali Island, they are not erasing his ideas. His ideas still exist. They're still out there. And in fact, they've elevated him by arresting him and putting him on Imrali Island. They're not able to hide his ideas, but what they will lose out on is the ability to sign an agreement with someone that will actually be honored. And what I fear is if they continue to follow this policy of isolation, and if he were to pass away while incarcerated, they will create such a reservoir of bad will amongst the Kurdish population that it will almost be irreparable, and that they are really going to miss out on a very unique opportunity to achieve a lasting and historic peace, in southeastern Turkey, northern Kurdistan, in that entire region, and establish a peace for decades to come. So that would be my recommendation for them. Some Turkish leader needs to have the wisdom to send a delegation to Imrali to release Abdel Öcalan onto house arrest or something, to begin opening negotiations in the same way that South Africa did with Nelson Mandela, because he really is the only person that can make that agreement, and they need to take this opportunity now while it still lasts. Thank you.
Thank you, Thoreau, for sharing that. Yeah, indeed, yeah, very sensible perspective about, the very pragmatic need for a solution in Turkey, even if one seems so far away at the present moment, and a reminder that there can be light at the end of the tunnel. And finally, our last two panellists, Dr. Hauzin, would you like to share a few final words?
Thank you, Matt. Well, to come back to the theme of the panel, it's, Öcalan Book Week. So I think my last comments would be to place responsibility on the individual. It is up to us. As Fazila so eloquently mentioned, each society is different, and it is up to us to liberate our own societies. We can certainly look at what is happening in Rojava and the Kurdish liberation movement and learn from it, but it is up to us to analyze our own societies, to read Ocalan very closely, to discuss it, to have dialogue about it, take what we can from it and implement it into our own societies and into the specific types of oppressions that we experience in each specific setting, and try to create our own homegrown, so to speak, liberation at home. And I think reading Ocalan is a wonderful step to start in that direction.
Yes, thank you, Hazin. And yeah, finally, I thought I'd leave the last word today really to Raparine, who's speaking to us from Rojava, where some of these ideas have left the page and are being communicated into everyday reality. Raparine.
Thank you. Yes, I was actually wanting to say something very similar, because I was thinking about this last question about how are the ideas growing? How are we able to measure how the ideas are growing in the world? I think before we try to measure them in the world, we should first look at ourselves. We should measure how we each are adopting these ideas, because this is the way that they grow. They grow through our own actions, through our own words, through us being active and not passively waiting for them to happen around us. So in the same sense, I'm very excited about this new Ocalan Books Day. I think this is very, very wonderful. And I think in the future, it will really be very positive. But it's still just the first step. We should all for sure be going out and reading together and discussing. But the next step we really need to put into practice. We need to take action. We need to take these ideas and run with them, because they are very international. And like the other panelists were saying, for sure, contextualize them. Have deeper analysis about your own context, about your own history. But how much are you as an individual taking liberation and taking freedom as the essence of your own life? How much are you adopting these ideas? How much are you changing your own life to be based around the essence of freedom and truth? And these are the ways that we can really measure how widespread these ideas are getting. Because we make it, we start with it in ourselves. So I thank you again for having me today. I was very excited to speak in this panel with everyone. And it was very nice also to get to know some of the other panelists and hear their thoughts. And I wish success to everyone.
Thank you very much. To wrap it into all of our panelists. I think it's a great testament to the appeal and the depth of these ideas and these books we've been talking about today, that they can bring together such a diverse and well-informed and experienced panel to share really interesting reflections. And I'm sure we could speak for much longer, but let's bring our discussion today to a close. The recording of this event will be available on the MedNews website, as will be a short summary. So please do visit the MedNews website and also follow MedNews on Twitter if you're not already, and keep sharing the coverage and particularly the events and the discussions which that site is able to foster between people across, I think, three continents today, which is not bad for a Sunday night. So thank you very much once again to all of our panellists, to Dr. Throy Redcrow, to Dr. Hazin Aziz, who I hope can now get some sleep, to Fazila Mohammed, particularly speaking to us from South Africa and sharing her depth and wealth of experience, and to Raparine joining us from Kurdish-led Northeast Syria. I've been Matt Broomfield with MedNews. Thank you very much, everyone, and have a good night. Goodbye.